We're talking a little bit about the subject that there are some people that take, we discussed it yesterday, that approach the mitzvahs as though they were like some types of taboo phenomena. That is, those things that are prohibited are insidious types of things beyond reason. It's not that, as we look at it, that it's a derech ha-chaim, it's a way of life, and that the Torah is taking you away from a wrong pathway. That is, if a person were to eat the forbidden food, in and of itself, there's nothing in that food that's going to be harmful to him, but rather, if he follows the pathway of the instincts, he's going to be living a completely instinctual life, and the same thing with the forbidden sexual relations. Now, a major proof that there's nothing really intrinsic to anything that's prohibited. Well, of course, I mean, I'm not talking about things like murder and of that sort. Obviously, that's performing an intrinsic evil. I don't mean that there's no such thing as an intrinsic evil in the Torah. But I'm talking in the realm of many of the mitzvos, the forbidden foods, forbidden sexual relations, etc. The reason this is coming up is because we read from time to time that groups of ultra-Orthodox Jews that tend to look at it this way in that kind of an absolutist kind of a sense, and they are absolute in the sense of our commitment to keep them, but not in the way that they understand it. And it's also a defect in character that when people, this is an important point, that when people observe, religious people observe others not observing the religion or violating the religion, how they react is a indication of their level. And those who tend to get exceedingly upset and angry and want to attack or kill the people, generally speaking, as a general rule, that's a very serious defect. Most, of course, first of all, it partakes of anger. And the Rambam said that a person should overcome anger, go to the other extreme. So how do they explain that? These people are overcome by anger. So that's wrong. The Rambam said that person is a koes, someone who partakes of anger, it's like he avodah zarah, it's ovid avodah zarah. You can see how it operates over here. Because the ovid avodah zarah is not, it's not a true recognition of a creator, it's certainly not the case. It's a very primitive type of a phenomenon. He's attached to his own emotional desire that there be some type of a being that's there just to protect him. So that type of a being has, that person has a lot of anger and frustration and jealousy and rage against any other type of a system, because it undermines his feelings. He feels very insecure. Now, religious people, when they react in that manner of rage, are being no different than ordinary idol worshippers. Look at all the suffering that was inflicted upon the Jews throughout history, only because we rejected their God, their quote-unquote God, put it that way. That's one of the worst condemnations of Christianity throughout its history, and Islam and today too. That type of religious fanaticism, which is rooted in very primitive emotions, which cannot tolerate the idea that anybody else is different than them. Why? Why should a person react that way? Why do you care if somebody does not agree with your views? Why should that make you angry? Now, that's pretty much the case. There's always a lot of rivalry, whether it be political differences, any type of thing where people have very strong feelings, convictions, and when others disagree with them, it puts them in a rage. That's a very serious flaw. It's a character flaw. So that you'd imagine that Jews who keep the Torah, which is the way of God, the way of perfection, wouldn't act that way. The Rambam said, again, that a person should perfect, should direct all of his emotions, his emotional dispositions, towards the correct pathway. Some of them are to be gratified in moderation, but he says that some of them are completely to be restrained, one of them being anger. So these religious fanatics who react with significant anger at anyone who, and basically it's not even based upon the fact that the person is not necessarily a good Jew or a good person, it's just that they're different than them. It's a reflection of a very low level, primitive level. They're not in conformity with the Torah. The truly perfected individual would not get angry at people who don't live according to the Torah. Why should you? Why should you even care? Why should it bother you so much? Is it because you're so compassionate and so concerned about mankind? So if that's the case, then your feeling should be one of compassion and sympathy and try to help the person, if that's the case. But you realize that by getting angry and screaming and hurling abuse, you're not helping them, that's for sure. It's definitely not it's not calculated to bring them any closer. So that most religious people should strive to achieve a certain level of indifference. Indifference to the religious behavior of others. I know that philosophically we're supposed to be concerned about other people, religiously. But that's philosophically. I'm saying that there's a lot of wrong reasons why people are so concerned. The concern that most religious people claim that they feel for others who are not as religious, to me, is very suspicious. I'm suspicious of it. I don't just say it's wonderful that they're so concerned. You have to test it out and see where it stems from. If it stems from a certain fanaticism of insecurity that it bothers them that other people are not like them, then it's not a reflection of any kind of perfection. A person should sort of reach the level, first of all, of indifference, emotional indifference. People are very selfish by nature. How much do we really care about others? People don't lose sleep. The only time it becomes a calamity is when it happens close to home. That's what the definition of a calamity is. So a person should kind of strive to reach the point where he's not bothered on an emotional plane, on a gut reaction plane. Because the gut reaction is not based upon true compassion, true religious compassion. True religious compassion is a very, very hard thing to strive for. Then you should act in a manner which reflects true religious compassion, would be that you would do acts which sanctify God. You would do acts of genuine chesed, of genuine compassion, to go out of your way to be nice to people in spite of the fact that they're not observant. Now, getting back to the point that was raised about the reaction of, this was raised by Jesse, the reaction of the Jews. There was a case a few months ago where supposedly some ultras beat up a girl who was not, they deemed to be not dressed properly because she was wearing denim, whatever the case is, it doesn't really matter to me. So what the question is, their idea that having to witness such a thing is very detrimental, it's very harmful to them, because this is something which is prohibited by the Torah, and this person subjected them to something which is prohibited by the Torah. Now, there is, of course, a category in Judaism. There is a category of forbidden thoughts. For example, sexual thoughts. Now, this is more serious, obviously, for a man. So, one could argue that that's true, that men should not go to movies or look at magazines or, you know, gaze at women in an immodest state because this arouses sexual thoughts. Since a man can have an emission, and that's seriously prohibited, so it's a greater prohibition upon him. So that's a legitimate point, that therefore it's incumbent upon men, religious men, to refrain from those kinds of things. They should avoid going to the beach or places where women are dressed immodestly. That's for sure. Of course, the obligation is basically upon them. Now, in their circles, the women are supposed to dress modestly and not to violate that. That's part of the whole, then that's correct, and that makes sense. But the question is, let's say one particular case where someone was immodest and they had this feeling that some terrible, terrible thing was done. I don't agree with that. First of all, so don't look at her. Why can't you just close your eyes? That's why God created eyelids. You close your eyes, you don't look. However, what I'm saying is like this, is that there's no single experience. If you just happen to see a beautiful girl one time and she wasn't dressed nicely, that's not going to destroy your soul. That doesn't make sense. The Torah, there are situations where, for example, the Torah permits a person to eat the treif. We learned about that. The soldier in battle is permitted to eat all kinds of treif if he's hungry and there's no kosher food readily available. This is not a situation of pikuach nefesh. The Torah didn't want to burden the soldiers. They're going into battle. They have a lot to do. So they should keep kosher, all things being equal. But if they don't keep kosher, the Torah didn't want them to have that extra burden of not eating and whatever difficulties it may be out in the field to get kosher. So then it simply said they eat the treif. There was a story during the last war, the Lebanon war, where apparently there were a lot of mix-ups in terms of the supply lines and so forth. A lot of stories came out of there. They weren't up to speed. And one story was these soldiers weren't getting they didn't have food. But they took over a Lebanese house. A house on the border, wherever the fighting was, South Lebanon. And they were hungry. And there was a lot of food there. It was just all treif. And the soldier remembered he was religious, and he remembered the halacha. That's what the Rambam says. And houses malayim kol tov, filled with all goodly things. So it's referred to as goodly things. So how could the Torah call something goodly, which is an abomination, according to them? It means to say that there's nothing wrong with the chazir. The Rambam says this is a reference to the necks of pig. So it means that, so what's going to happen? The person's going to eat chazer. How is he going to ever get over that? How is that going to, what are we saying? That there's no choice? It's between that and dying? It's not between that and dying. It's just it's not a good way to fight a war. Kosher style. And also the soldier that's v'chashakdava, that he sees the afas toar. How would they answer that one, Jesse? He sees this beautiful shiksa in the, the captured city. In the siege, v'chashaktava, and he has a lust, he has a desire. So it says, v'lkach t'lchol isha, take her for a wife. You can have her. The Torah, and Rashi says that's a concession to the Yetzer. Okay, there's a procedure that he has to go through. But according to Rambam, he could have the first bia with her, then he takes it to a house, and there's a procedure. Because the Torah wants to discourage the marriage. That's a very interesting phenomenon. It doesn't prohibit it, but it certainly doesn't endorse it, and it acts in strategic ways to bring about a discouragement. That's an interesting philosophy that you can learn a lot, because we generally don't do it that way. When we're against something, we go straight out, and sometimes we don't act in a correct way. The Torah is using a strategy. Take some time, and she has to grow her nails, and she can't dress up. There's a whole procedure. He has to see her and she cries, and hopefully he gets tired of her. Reality sets in. And then at the end of the day, he makes the correct decision. But it permits him to have sexual relations with her. I generally introduce it and say that nobody could ever, no frum person would ever anticipate this halacha. That is, if he hadn't learned this parsha, and you asked him, what do you think the Torah would say about that? He would say, it's hard. Of course it's prohibited. And yet, the Torah did make this concession to the Yetzer Hara. But it wouldn't do so if it was just destroying the person. So that's how much more so we're talking about something which doesn't even come close. You're talking about a girl who's not dressed modestly, and you happen to see her one time, and that's what lasting effect? I mean, that leaves that idea of a lasting effect, that you'll never be the same? I don't agree with that. The problem with these types of things is that becomes part of the person's lifestyle. And his energies are drawn in that direction, and it takes him away from learning, and he becomes more involved in the world of lust and emotionalism and so forth. That's the false lifestyle. But one time a person saw something, or an occasional viewing of something, so God created the mind, you forget it, wears off, and that's the end of that. There's no, what's the whole idea of a Baal Tshuva? He can change and he can reach a higher level. I mean, according to them, they could never say that the Baal Tshuva is on a higher plane. A Baal Tshuva is someone who tasted sin and he renounces it. All right, theoretically, who could reach the highest possible... the level and what will be the effect will be there. There'll be a battle but that's not because of a one-time thing. That's because if something became entrenched in your nature, even though you're changing your path, that also depends when. I mean, the earlier the better. The longer you stay submerged in a lifestyle, so when you do change, the less able you are to completely uproot and to reach the level you might have reached had you started earlier. That's true. But that's not what we're talking about. The reason why people have this attitude, and it's very hard for people to accept it, is, in my opinion, due to the superego, the guilt factor. Guilt is a very powerful factor. And at some point, everybody has guilt, obviously. And especially religious people. Because in your religious upbringing, it's virtually impossible to avoid the element of guilt. I don't know that it's possible. I don't think it's possible. And true, as you get older and more mature, it can be a dangerous thing also. The more you rationally become about religion, the more you loosen the effect of the superego, then it becomes difficult to control yourself. Because you're able to rationalize sin. So that's the danger. There is a danger in the philosophical approach. You got to go very, very slowly because the power of reason is not as strong emotionally as the power of the superego. That's a very powerful emotional thing which gives a person a fear of sinning. That's so that when you do something wrong, you feel tremendous guilt. And the feeling that you have is not commensurate with the way I presented it. But it's not just sin. Forget about sin. Let's say it's not sin. It's enjoyment. It's pleasure. The problem is that since there's a powerful superego repression about certain things, then very often people who are raised that way suffer from guilt, even when they're doing things that are permitted. For example, sexual guilt. There's a lot of people that suffer from sexual guilt, even though they're keeping halacha. They're doing what they're doing is perfectly permitted. Not only permitted, it's a good thing. Within the whole context of the marriage, the situation, and so on and so forth. But very often people will suffer guilt because they're having too much fun or having too much pleasure. And they've been raised, I guess, up to a certain amount, but then it becomes too much. Because the way the superego works is that it doesn't just gear itself. It doesn't gear itself just to the realm of the prohibited and the permitted. It carries over even because it blocks out that activity. That activity which could be prohibited. You see, in Christianity, that's the way it goes. Christianity is good and bad. I mean, the instincts are bad. So sex is a sin. That's their view. Except for procreation. Religious Catholics have a hard time with it because I think theoretically anyways, I don't know, I'm not up to date with their current theology, but that's the classical theology, is that it's evil. Well, man is evil by nature, so I don't know how they work these things out, but according to them, you see, a priest is not allowed to have sex because, well, why not? Because it's evil. But you have to procreate, so then it's okay, whatever. But then I think, strictly speaking, that they're not permitted only when she could become pregnant. In Judaism, it's different because our approach is that one's guilt, one's feeling about oneself, guilt, is not with the act itself. Because there's no single act that's intrinsically evil or good. It depends on the context, even murder. Even murder, if it's a wicked person, you shouldn't feel guilty. If you kill an Amalekite, if you're Amalek, so then you shouldn't feel guilty. You should rejoice, you should feel happy. Your emotion should be in line with objective reality, with the truth, not with regard to a certain direction of a superego, of an emotion, which is blind. It's emotional blindness. The perfected individual, his emotions are in line with the truth. That's a good point. People completely misconstrue, our derech in terms of the emotions. They think that we just block out the emotions. It's not true. To the contrary, emotional fulfillment is the ultimate sign of perfection, when the person's emotions are in line with the good, when the person does good and feels good, when the person, and even if that good thing is something which the superego associates as evil. The superego doesn't know. The superego is blind. It just goes up to a certain point. Sex. Oh, sex. No, but the thinker says that sex is not good, sex is not bad. It depends. So where it's bad, so then the person feels guilty because he did the wrong thing. Where it's good, then he feels good about himself. It's a differentiating kind of a superego. It's a rationalized kind of a guilt. We know rational guilt. Guilt is good when the cause is just, when it's the person did the wrong thing. Like David HaMelech. First he went ahead with that census, for whatever reasons. And he wasn't cognizant that it was wrong at that point. It eluded him. And then at a certain point he became cognizant of the fact that he had done something wrong. Then it says, Vayach Levavo, that his heart smote him. That's like a feeling of guilt. Then the emotion came in. The emotion was in line with the knowledge, with the awareness that he had done the wrong thing. That's a state of perfection. If a parent chastises a child in a manner which calls for it, with intelligence, with thought, with restraint, and causes the child to feel bad, and the parent considered it and did it, knowing then it would be like a doctor performing a certain procedure which is necessary and therapeutic for the patient, and it causes the patient a certain amount of pain, the doctor will feel happy. Well, let's backtrack on that. Should the parent feel bad and say, it hurts me and I feel bad about it, but I'm going to do it anyways, or the parent should feel good about what they just did? In this particular case, the suffering that I'm imposing is good for you. I'm talking where the parent thought it out and is doing the right thing. It's going to save the kid's life. The answer is that it seems that there isn't a level of compassion. A doctor can have compassion for the suffering of the patient. That doesn't mean he feels bad about what he did. That is, insofar as you... Many times, if you're the cause of that pain, so then it's not just that you feel bad for the pain, you sort of feel bad about yourself now, that you question maybe you did the wrong thing and you feel a certain guilt. It causes you to feel bad about yourself. If you discipline the student, and let's assume you did the right move, so if you feel bad for the student and you commiserate with their suffering, that's fine, but it doesn't make you feel bad about yourself. But very often it's going to cause certain guilt within yourself. The reaction of the student is going to cause you to question that maybe I did the wrong thing. So that's the problem. That's where the parental guilt kicks in. Again, the emotion of guilt is not directed towards the actual abstract good. It's directed towards certain superficial aspects. Thus, when you make the child happy, you do something to make him happy. Even though it could be bad for him, you feel okay about yourself. And when you do something with a child that causes pain, even if it was the right thing to do, you feel bad about it. Because the emotion in its pristine state is not directed at that which is good. It's directed at certain superficial things that may be connected to what's good. But that can be very, very harmful. Now, getting back to something we discussed yesterday about the sin of Shaul. And why that was so bad that he had to lose the kingship? Well, I just wanted to give my answer was that because in this particular case, it was the violation of a tzivui, of the Navi, of a command. But the way he did it was kind of, would appear to be something that could be justified for most people. In terms of the ordinary way of looking at it, if you saw what he said, it didn't look so bad. If he had to make the case that he fulfilled the command, that's a very interesting thing. The way people look at, the popular way of looking at it, would say, he did everything, what do you want? I mean, so he took a few sheep to offer as a sacrifice. That's the sin. That would be very hard. That would be very hard for people to accept. That's why there was such a pressure upon him. But, That's the deviation from the word of Hashem in accordance with the way it appears to man and what's appealing to man. That's the challenge of this generation. That's why there's hardly anybody that, very, very hardly anybody that got upset with the Pope visiting the synagogue. Because that seems to make, you can make a case, it seems to make a lot of sense, and the negatives, the idea that this is contrary to the tzivui, to the command of God, in terms of drawing close to idolatry, and praising idolatry, and so on, and the impact. There's only, the only newspaper that's really, the Yiddish newspaper that I read, the Allgemeine Journal. You have that problem in the world of, not to mention conservative and reform, which is a joke. I mean, they can just justify anything. They've adopted a methodology of thinking which can justify anything. It's like a clever lawyer who can make a case for such and such. It's like judges with the Constitution. You could read a right. I mean, it's a game. It's a game. You take the Constitution and find certain ideals and values, and you just eliminate other things. Well, the Constitution itself is not that specific and clear, like there's a halachic system. But to take that same approach to Torah and to twist it around until you're able to create the rationalization for certain changes which are very appealing to man. That's very appealing today. Modern. That's modern orthodoxy. Some, you know, I'm not saying they all, but they will, it's a very big attraction to do that. To make those deviations. And that's what the, that's the problem. That's what we discussed yesterday. That's the parsha. That in observing Judaism, you have no right to do that. That undermines the whole system. Because well, once you do that, there's no stopping. And you basically, you're not observing the command of God. You're not elevating yourself towards the objective command. You're just following what you really deep down want in your own heart. And then projecting it as though that's what the Torah is saying. So your understanding of Torah is pretty much a reflection of what you desire within your own heart. It's not, you're not being elevated to something which is outside of your desires, an objective ideal. Now, no one's perfect, but at least that should be the philosophy. That's what we should be striving for. This is an interesting story I want to share. It's from a book about Rabbi Kahane, Rabbi Meir Kahane, written by his wife. She's very meticulous. She's a librarian. So she's written Volume 1, which is a huge book. And a lot of times people write biographies with, you know, an axe to grind, whatever. She's very, very scholarly, gathering together all the sources, and, you know, she's got footnotes for everything. I read an interesting story over here. We're discussing something else now. The question has been raised about two sins, two major sins. One is Avodah Zarah, idolatry. The other one is Sinat Chinam, which is generally translated as baseless hatred. And both are very serious. For example, Sfira, during Sfira in the mornings, the students of Rabbi Akiva, so that their sin was that they did not display respect for one another. And the general idea of Chazal is that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the sin of Avodah Zarah. If you study the prophets, you know, pertaining to the Bais Rishon, the first temple, it was the sin of Avodah Zarah. And then the second one is the sin was that they sinas chinam, baseless hatred. So both are very serious, and both are connected to the destruction of the temple. Questions being raised, is it possible for us to decide which one is worse? It's a good point being made. Whenever you raise a question to try and compare one thing to another, like which sin is worse, or which mitzvah is greater, there's different contexts. You have to establish what the context is. Because something, like the Rambam says about the Avera, the sin of murder, that destroys the habitation of the world, destroys society, and so on. He says that even though it's not the worst of the sins of the world, but it's treated more harshly. in terms of even if a person, you have that phenomenon called the kippah, that if a person can't be found guilty because of legal technicalities, then we have other ways of dealing with him, to eliminate him. And that's the only sin where we do things like that, because it destroys yeshuva shalom. It destroys civilization, so to speak. I mean, you can't function without a society. You need a base. So that from the purely spiritual angle of the sin, there's two things to consider. Each sin brings about a certain amount of corruption of the soul, the destruction of the soul. So clearly, there's different degrees in terms of the corruption that's in this, involved in that particular sin. You can measure. You can measure it from the standpoint of a minor. Going in and stealing, robbing a bank, is worse than being too lazy to pick up someone's lost object and returning it to him. I would say. I think everybody would agree. No. It's more egregious to actually plan a robbery and all that. And stealing someone's money is not as serious as beating the heck out of him. Because, all right, stealing money is significant, and again, you can measure if a person was desperate and needed some money, stole $10, as opposed to someone that got angry at someone and put him in the hospital. So obviously, from the standpoint of the corruption of the soul, you can differentiate. But the point has to be made that there's another angle. The aspect of sinas chinam is from the standpoint of the society. That's what you find by the generation of the flood. That even though they committed a serious moral transgressions, the Ramban says that their fate was sealed because of the theft. Why? Because even though there's worse sins, but when it reached a point that, because these are rational laws that govern society, and they reached a point where they were incapable of functioning in a rational manner for self-preservation. So that's a different angle. It's a different angle then. So if you can ask the question, which is worse, sinas chinam or avodah zarah, you have to ask yourself, what's your standpoint? Are you asking in terms of the destruction of the soul? Which is worse from this, or which is worse from the social, from the standpoint of the social order? In terms of the destruction of the soul, there's no sin that's worse than avodah zarah. That's the whole essence. What's the whole point of having a social order, an appropriate society, and all of that? What's the whole point? To know God. So the ultimate good for man is the knowledge of God, and the ultimate objective in terms of eliminating sin is to eliminate avodah zarah. Idolatry. That's the worst. In fact, it's the only sin that can't be suspended even on Hara Shah. Every sin of the Torah can be suspended momentarily. It's called Hara Shah. By a Navi, by a prophet. If the prophet comes, he's a legitimate prophet, and he says that God sent him to suspend this and that mitzvah, but temporarily. Can't be permanently, because if it's permanently, then he's a false prophet, because you can't change the Torah. But if it's temporarily, then it's legitimate because of Hara Shah. Except for one, and that is Avodah Zarah. And the Rambam gives the analogy, it's like a doctor will eliminate the limbs, certain limbs, to save the patient. So too, certain mitzvos of the Torah can be suspended to save the patient. Obviously, it would have to be something that would be necessary and make sense in the context of saving the Torah, saving the Jewish people. But that does not apply to Avodah Zarah. If he would say that God instructed you to do a certain action, which is Avodah Zarah, temporarily, then we would reject him. There'd never be any justification for that. I mean, it seems clear that would seem to be the lesson of the Megillah. That even though at the cost of the decree to destroy the Jewish nation, Mordechai didn't give in terms of refusing to bow, because he regarded that as idolatry. So it would seem from that point of view that sinas chinam is an imperfection. It's a serious defect. It's a serious imperfection. So if we're looking at it from that angle, it's two different things. It's got to be considered two different things. That is to say that you have two foundations of the Torah. You have the Bein Adam LaMakom and Bein Adam LaChavero. Now, the first five of the Aseret Divros is all pertaining to man's relationship with God. So, that's the arena of the true idea of Hashem, and not to have idolatry. The second five is something else. That's to achieve the perfection of man in terms of what the Bein Adam LaChavero. The Rambam talks about that. And he says that the second category, those laws that are designed because man is a social animal and he has to live within a societal order, are very, very important, but they are not in the same level of importance as the first kind, those which teach a person true ideas, true opinions about God, about reality. So it would seem to me that the sin of Avodah Zarah, nothing can compare to that. That's complete destruction of the soul. The sin of Sinas Chinam, however, is a defect, it's a flaw, insofar as man is a social being and he has to seek perfection. Of course, it also, no question, everything is connected to his attitude. Obviously, if he had the correct idea of God and all that, then it should carry over, but it's not the same thing, it seems to me. That's something that he can work on, he can improve, and he has to work in his personality. He's got certain emotions, certain emotional defects. It's an emotional defect. The sin of Sinas Chinam is an emotional defect. But the sin of Avodah Zarah is a spiritual, it's the cancer of the spiritual aspect of man. The phenomenon of an ir hanidachas, that would seem to be the worst the type of a calamity in Israel. A whole city has been corrupted, and that whole city is utterly destroyed. It's a Jewish city, because it was corrupted into idolatry. So, and the seducer, the Mesis, who seduces somebody into idolatry, is treated more severely than in the legal system. This would seem to indicate that the idolatry is the worst avera. And indeed, that was the sin for which the Egel, that God was going to destroy Klal Yisrael, were it not for the tefillah of Moshe. So I don't know what the case is being, how the case is being made. It's not being explained. It is true that they associate the Second Temple's destruction with baseless hatred, but the case is not being made. Why? Why is that worse then? No. Why is the exile longer? What's going on here? Explain that. Now, the next step, of course, is to analyze the phenomenon of Sinas Chinam. What is it? And what's the cause of it? And why is it considered such a serious sin? It definitely is a serious sin. So what is the essence of that sin? That's what we should ask. Obviously, we can see the effects that it produces bad effects and so on and so forth, but that's not the complete story. Why is that such a terrible corruption that people are worthy of being destroyed for that? All right, so one idea. First, we have to take a look at what exactly are the causes of the phenomenon of Sinas Chinam and what the negatives are. Why does a person hate others? So that's an important thing. Usually when you have an irrational hatred, and probably most of the hatreds are irrational, so then it indicates a certain defect within yourself. That this person arouses certain things within yourself that you don't want to face in yourself, so that therefore instead of facing them, you tend to hate the other person. And that's how we said that's the underlying mechanism behind Lashon Hara. They're all part of a series of trying to bring others down. The intelligent person, when you feel these emotions, you shouldn't try to repress them. You should not. I've said this many times. You should go with it. Try to figure it out. Trace it. It's an indication of something about yourself. See, most people don't want to do that. They don't want to accept. So the person will say, I'll just stop thinking about it. I'll just push it out of my mind. I'll repress the feeling of hatred. Okay, so then you're not guilty of baseless hatred, but you're not getting the benefit. The real thing is to ask yourself, why do I feel this feeling? Not to be afraid of the fact that you feel that feeling. It seems that the baseless hatred, we've been discussing this at the outset. That's what we discussed at the outset. Religious people who just feel instinctive anger and hatred against people who are different than them. Religious hatred. So what's the cause of that? That would indicate a defect in terms of your whole attitude towards God. That's a, as we said, it's an idolatrous relationship, even if you believe in the true God. But the nature of the belief is one which is not leading to any kind of a perfection of the soul. To the contrary, it is utilized for something which is an imperfection of the soul. It becomes something which enables you to feel superior to others. Your whole idea of a relationship with God is based upon the desire to have like a personal God, like to build you up and make you feel special and better and better than other people. So that's a misuse, so to speak, of the whole significance of the emunah that a person should have. The awareness of God should make a person feel humble. There's something wrong when the belief of a certain person's religious beliefs serve as an outlet for his anger and frustration. Yet that's what it is, for example, all of these terrorists. They have tremendous anger and frustration and hatred, and they need an outlet for it, and then they find this religious, these doctrines, and they preach war against the unbelievers. They need an enemy, in search of an enemy. There are certain people that are searching for an enemy. They need to have an enemy. And they've seized onto the religion to bolster their ego. They have a certain ego deficiency. They've seized onto the religion to bolster their ego and to give a legitimacy towards their anger at other people. So while it may not be directly Avodah Zarah, because the doctrine itself, they can affirm the correct doctrine, but it is a defect in terms of the significance. That the conviction, that is, we're supposed to have a conviction in Hashem. That's the foundation of foundations. And it should be accurate insofar as it's possible. And it should not partake of anything false. But there's another element to it. And that is the impact that it has. You're supposed to have that conviction because that should be the foundation. It's supposed to have a certain impact upon your soul. And it should lead, that's the stepping stone to perfection, the desire to recognize God, to serve God, to draw closer to God, to fear God, and so on and so forth. So then the person is moving away more and more from the bolstering of his own ego. And this should foster a certain attitude towards himself, his imperfections, towards other people, and so on and so forth. In Sinas Chinam, you're going to the other extreme, where the entire point is not for the real perfection. The impact it's having is a negative impact. He's using that idea to serve unholy types of desires. This is a person who, instead of serving God, sort of identifies with God, becomes his cause. So that he confuses. He confuses his own anger with the anger of God. That's a zealot. And the person is incapable of self-knowledge. See, with these types of religious zealots, you can't talk to them, you can't reason with them. It's completely consumed them, and they can't see the possibility. They're so identified that this is, you know, they think that this is godly, but it's not. It's their own ego. What they're fighting for is their own ego, but their ego has become associated with God. That's the truth of the matter is, it is a form of idolatry. At the end of the day, because it's not really God that they're fighting for, it's their own ego. But in order to bolster their ego, they've allowed their ego to become associated with God. They don't see it's really their own ego. They're not fighting for God. It's their own thing. That's why they get so angry. It's like you offended them. And they don't have a knowledge of psychology. Because if they had a knowledge of psychology, they'd realize that it's got to be at an extremely high level to really be upset about the honor of God. That you know, most people are just upset about their own things. I mean, I shared this with you in the past. The Book of Rus, which we'll be reading soon on Shavuot, when Naomi goes back, she suffered great tragedies. She lost her husband and her two sons. And she then is going back. The famine ended, and she's going back to the land of Israel. and her daughters-in-law are very attached to her. But she's trying to convince them that they have to go back home now. You know, she's leaving, and why would they want to? She's discouraging them, basically. Discouraging them from converting, according to the halachic interpretation. Vatoma Nomi, Shovna Benosai. Nomi said, please return my daughters. Loma Te Lachna Imi, why would you go with me? Ha'od Livanim B'mei, do I have any more sons in my womb? V'hoi Lachem Lanashim, that would be husbands to you. And so on, she continues along these lines. And then, it's a very, very dramatic scene. Then they all lifted their voices and they all cried. Then Arpa left, and Rus Dafkaba. Rus clung to her. And then she tries to convince Rus to leave. And Rus is adamant. Don't even try to talk to me about this, to abandon you and to leave you. And then you have the famous expression, for wherever, where you go, I will go. Where you will lodge, I will lodge. Your nation is my nation, and your God is my God. And she continues, and where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. And she sort of takes a vow. Though thus may Hashem do to me, and even more so, if anything but death will separate us. Then it says, Vatera ki misametzes hi laleches. And she, that is, Rus, saw that she was strengthening herself, forcing herself, or determined. It's translated as determined to go with her. Then she stopped. That is to say, in line with the halachic, we learned the halacha from here, that at the outset you're supposed to discourage someone who's interested in converting, and they have to demonstrate their absolute determination. And then, at a certain point in time, you stop discouraging them. You don't want to over-discourage either. There's a famous pshat of the Vilna Gaon. I don't have the exact words. That is, what does it mean that she saw that she was forcing herself to go, or determined? It's a midrashic kind of a pshat. I mean, he's making a point. That is, he's learning that that she saw that she was sort of, she had to force herself to go. That is that Rus was now struggling and forcing herself as though there was a tremendous resistance. So the whole point was that he said that the Yetzer Hara, the objective of the evil inclination, is always to get a person to follow it and to sin. And the Yetzer HaTov in a person only wants to do good. That's the way he presented it. I'm presenting it very, very loosely here. And sometimes he says that the Yetzer Hara does not succeed directly in getting a person, because the person will fight against. So what does the Yetzer Hara do? It disguises itself in the guise of a mitzvah. It takes on the appearance of the Yetzer HaTov, of the good inclination. That is to say, it's an important point that a lot of times a person has a tremendous desire to do something. That is to say, when a person has a desire to get involved in a mitzvah, now, according to this calculation, there's two possibilities. Either this is an expression of the Yetzer HaTov, okay, wants to do a good thing, because the Yetzer wants to do good things, or it's an expression of the Yetzer Hara, because sometimes the Yetzer Hara can only seduce a person when it finds a goodly cause. I mean, a lot of times people are involved in all kinds of good causes, but deep down there's other reasons, for fame, or they want to meet certain people, whatever it is, but you can masquerade. So he said, how can you know the difference? How do you know when you're involved in something that's a good activity? How do you know if you're doing it for the right reasons? If it's an expression of the goodly inclination, the Yetzer HaTov, or it could be an expression of the Yetzer Hara. How do you know? So he said that if the person feels a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and emotional desire to do it, he says that then it's a good sign that it comes from the Yetzer Hara. Because it's not in the nature of the Yetzer HaTov. The Yetzer HaTov is always involved in a struggle, and it's a fight, it's a difficulty, because that's the way a person is. A person is emotional, instinctual, and so on and so forth. So if a person is engaged in something which is a good project, and they feel this powerful, powerful enthusiasm and desire, so then it's, well, you should check it. Maybe it's not really the Yetzer HaTov. Maybe there's something deeper, because that type of a feeling is not natural. It's not natural that people feel that way about mitzvos. Normally they feel that way about, they get all excited about the instinctual things. So therefore you should check it. So that's what he said. That after all of the dialogue up and back, where she discouraged, then she's learning it. I would say it's a little bit contrary to the plain meaning, but it's a midrashic point. Because the plain meaning is that she refused to give in, but it does carry that idea that she was forcing herself, meaning that it became very difficult for her. That Rus waited and saw that it became was very, very difficult. I'm sorry, that Naomi waited and saw that Rus, now there was no natural emotion. It was very, very difficult, and she was forcing herself to do it. That shows that it's really from the Yetzer HaTov. The proof that it was really from the Yetzer HaTov and that it wasn't from the Yetzer Hara, which was masquerading, was that she wasn't just jumping and dancing and everything. You see a person, like an overnight, all of a sudden these people become Baal Tshuva overnight and they're singing and dancing. It doesn't work that way. That means that there's certain powerful, deep-seated emotions, and those emotions are attaching themselves to something. And you see that is very, very often the religiosity of people. Because it's like a very, very selfish thing. Suddenly they discovered God. Someone loves me. You know, like they have their own personal savior, that kind of thing. It's a very powerful emotional factor. So, however, individual who's really struggling for perfection is struggling. It's a struggle. Struggle because the person's aware of the emotions and the emotions are strong. And then there's the other part of you, the mind, and real religious perfection, there's going to be a conflict. It's not easy. It's not smooth. It's not overnight. And it happens when you have a lot of resistance. You don't fool yourself. And you overcome those resistances. That's a totally different kind of thing. The religious fanatics who beat people up and go crazy with all these things are basically, the corruption is that they don't see their own ego. They're really fighting for their own ego. It's like somebody insulted them. And they may even say that, but they believe that they're so perfected, it's a false sense of perfection. They believe that they're so perfected that their emotions really are bothered by the affront to the mitzvah or whatever it may be. But that's not the case. They can't see into the psychological process where it's just a matter of their own personal ego. To the contrary, if a person is really, truly caught up with the idea of Hashem, Hashem is always Racham, V'chanan, Erech Apayim, merciful to the sinners. In fact, that's the bracha. Because there's a bracha you're supposed to say even when you see a place of idolatry. There's a bracha, you say that... Haroa makom, a person sees a place, she'ovdim bo akom, with a idolatry. So he even makes a bracha in that case. Im mavarech, baruch atah Hashem l'kenem al cholam, she'noson erech apayim, la'ovrei ritzano. That he displays patience, so to speak. Slow to anger. That's a teaching also. That the... There's people in this world who are over Eretzono. What's God's reaction? That is Erech HaPayim. That's the way the world is designed. There's many, many factors. He doesn't necessarily immediately get angry, so to speak. God doesn't get angry, but you know what I'm talking about, descriptively. So then a person should be big enough to recognize that, and yet people go crazy. They have no Erech HaPayim. Now, these people who are religiously fanatic, and their claim they're doing it for the sake of God, well, if that's the case, so emulate the ways of God. Now, of course, there are times when you have to take action. I'm not saying no, but this is their knee-jerk reaction is to go crazy. So then it can't be because of their true appreciation for Hashem. They should be Erech HaPayim. And try to understand why this comes about. And try to deal with it in the most effective way. If you really care for the honor of God, so then you'll have to sit back not react instinctively, which may make things worse, and just see what can be done. Or maybe there's nothing can be done. Sometimes there's nothing can be done. Erech HaPayim, that's the way it is. If there is something that can be done. But just to react instinctively, how does that help?